First off, Miles, thank you for taking the time to
Sweet.
chat with me on your surely
Yeah.
busy schedule. So let's just get it started right off the
Oh,
bat. Where do you think technology, specifically AI and machine learning, will be going in the coming years?
I think AI is a very interesting field because it is so unpredictable. Just 10 years ago, we were coming out of what folks are now calling the AI winter, the capabilities of AI, for everything from Siri to GPT-3 to ImageNet and everything in between. So I think that it can be really hard to predict the direction that AI will go just because it is so stochastic, and unpredictable. But I think that's also partly what makes it so exciting, right? We don't know what's possible. And I guess the downside of that is we don't know what's impossible. But I think that the effect that it might have on society, I mean, God, I think that we'll find that many traditionally lower paying jobs will become obsolete. And I think people often say that, well, inevitably this will create new jobs, right? Like, sure, you will no longer have folks working the cashier at CVS. But maybe there'll be even more jobs in manufacturing, these systems or in engineering. But sometimes I think, what that conversation misses is the reason that I think AI will be adopted so quickly, if it becomes technically viable for a particular task. The reason that it's going to be adopted so quickly is that it will be cheaper than the human alternative, right? And it's that economic driver that's going to lead to development and deployment. And so sometimes I am skeptical of the people who say that, ultimately this will end up creating jobs, because I think that, part of the point is that it is getting rid of certain jobs. And the reason why, for example, tech workers in Silicon Valley are paid so much is that their job is essentially to automate away the work of far more people, right? Like, you don't need 10 million or 50 million engineers all writing code, right? There's, maybe I'm not creative enough, but I'm not sure that there's that much code to write, right? The whole purpose of automation is that you can have fewer people doing the work of more. I guess the broader point that I was trying to make is that I think that it will ultimately lead to a fewer number to fewer jobs. However, I think that it would ultimately probably be net good for society because there are ways to still give people income, to still give people capital, to still give people sort of weight in society and abilities to contribute that are meaningful. And whether that's through, for example, the arts or through just sort of expanding our minds to what is possible as an occupation. I think that even if jobs as we know them become obsolete, I'm not sure that that's necessarily a bad thing. There is a dystopian possibility too, which is decently likely. But we'll see. Sorry, I think I've gone off a bit on a bit of a tangent there.
No, it's fine. What do you think would be those main ways people would still have that alternative to a job, to still be able to bring in money so that they can buy food for their families and whatnot?
Yeah, so I mean this is such a sort of a deeply philosophical question. What is the purpose of artificial intelligence, right? Like, what is the reason that we're deploying it? Well, I think that in sort of the US economy, I think we can take sort of this narrow look, which is, well, it's to essentially create shareholder value, which is a very sort of, I think, you know, capitalist, ruthless, you know, market-focused answer. But then, you know, well, why do we have that? Well, in theory, that's supposed to sort of create a better society and distribute resources to people. And, you know, so I would say probably, you know, ultimately the purpose of deploying AI is to make life easier for people. That's my like naive rose-colored glasses probably view of it. And so what jobs will be remaining for folks, and what would labor look like in a world where so much is automated? Well, why don't we look at what happened during the Industrial Revolution, right? That was a period when so much of so many jobs were automated. And what ended up happening, and you know, maybe I'm misreading the history, but as I understand it, what ended up happening was instead of having folks sort of doing hard manual labor, people started instead sort of augmenting the machines. So the machines would do sort of the core physical work, and then you would have individuals sort of tending to the machines. And I think that, you know, we'll end up seeing a similar thing should automation really become even more pervasive than it already is, right? I think that you'll have sort of a new labor sector which is dedicated to overseeing these sort of deployments. I think that there will be a whole probably new industry of sort of created from the regulation of AI, folks whose job it is to explicitly sort of act as a watchdog over these AI systems. I think that there will be a lot more room in society for example, like things like the arts. You know, now that if in theory, you know, you have fewer people driving cars and tending, working in factories and working in, you know, grocery stores and working in warehouses, and working in logistics and shipping and all these industries that are sort of right now on the cusp of automation, I think you'll just have a lot of people who will end up probably, you know, provided there are effective ways to, you know, give people income, you know, perhaps that is a universal basic income, which I'm a fan of. That's my like pet policy. I think that you'll have a lot of people just finding meaning in other parts of their lives, which would probably mean a lot more people working in the arts, a lot more people, ideally retiring earlier, traveling. I do think that there are some areas that can't be automated as well. And I think that, you know, in the services industry, for example, I think that there will always be a place for human, for example, like servers at restaurants, mm-hmm. and people who work in caring and nursing and in the medical industry. It kind of feels heartless to call it the medical industry, but you know, like no matter, even if AI is incredibly effective at doing certain jobs, I don't think that it will be able to connect with humans in the same way that other humans are able to connect with other humans. Sorry, that's a beast of a sentence. but, you know, I think that people will ultimately want to be interacting primarily with humans. And so I think that the jobs that AI will take over will probably be the sort of jobs that are not necessarily fully visible in society, sort of, for the typical person, right? I still think that we will have human teachers. I still think that we will have human therapists. We'll have human police if we have police. I was about to say human firefighters, but perhaps we shouldn't. That, I feel like, might be a great place for robots.
Right.
You know, but like warehouse workers, already... You know, Amazon has far more robots than employees working in their warehouses. Don't cite me on, don't quote me on that. But, double check that. But I'd be shocked if that weren't true. And so I think that, you know, it's going to be the sort of jobs that are vital to keeping the world running as it is, but that aren't directly sort of customer facing, will be the ones that are automated. And the ones that are customer facing, or maybe I should say sort of human facing, will probably be the last to go. Yeah.
Yeah.
Feel free to ask me prodding questions if there's a particular idea that you want to explore more deeply.
Yeah, of course. I was actually going to say, because you were saying like the medical industry, and I don't know if you watched Google's keynote recently, Google I.O., they're working on mammography technology for using AI to better find early signs of breast cancer. Do you think that could be the future, where it's not even a doctor or a physician looking at you, it's just an AI looking at you and saying, oh, you have AFib, or you have a stigmatism in your left eye?
You know, that's a really interesting question. I think I sort of have two thoughts on this. The first thought is, I think that it is a fantastic idea to have sort of AI augmented medical care, right? Humans are fallible, and so are AI systems. But if they're built right with good data and good engineering, sort of good principles, right? An AI system is going to probably be far more reliable than a physician, and far less biased, and just sort of, dare I say, even more open-minded than a doctor, you know, when it comes to diagnoses. And so, I mean, you know, we're exiting my sort of field of expertise, if I can even say that I have an expertise. I don't really know that I do. But I know next to nothing about the medical industry from any perspective other than as a patient. But, you know, I don't think that we're close to the point where you won't have an actual doctor in the loop, right? So, you know, medical technology is remarkable, right? The fact that we even have the tools to do a mammogram, or we have tools to even do x-rays, and the x-rays are old, right? Those just empower doctors further, right? They didn't replace doctors. And I think that, you know, we'll probably see something similar, at least with the sort of nearest generation of medical AI systems. I don't think that they're going to replace doctors. I think that they're going to probably simply help doctors. I want to just point out that I think that a huge part of the job of a physician and of a nurse is not to perform medicine for some definition of performing medicine. I really think it's to comfort people and to communicate with people and to explain sort of complex issues and to people in ways that are understandable and to be personable and to give people advice and soothe them and be the sort of point of communication. And I don't think that an AI can do that. You know, maybe it will in the far future, but almost certainly not in the near future. We're still very much, I think, in the uncanny valley when it comes to AI systems assuming the roles of humans. So, I mean, you know, with medical care, I think, you know, with diagnoses and the sort of core medical work, or what we would consider core medical work, I think that, you know, almost certainly you'll have more and more AI systems performing that work. But I don't think that doctors themselves are on their way out.
So you're saying that you think the AIs will help do some of the heavy lifting, but doctors and nurses will still keep the personal touch, so to speak.
Yeah, I do. You don't want an AI to be telling you that you have cancer, right? That is the job of a person, of a doctor, who can explain your options in a caring, compassionate, empathetic way. I mean, this may lead to sort of class-based stratification. It may well be that they're like completely automated clinics that you go to if you're on, you know, certain care plans, or, you know, you can only afford so much, and then, you know, you have private practices that still have humans. So, you know, maybe that's the way this is going, but I do think that there will at least be demand for human care professionals far into the future.
Gotcha. So obviously you're in a more serious position with software engineering than myself, being that you're studying at Stanford. But do you think people like us doing software, how do you think we'll be affected by AI being used more and more?
I think that if you are an engineer, you are probably one of the people who's going to benefit most from AI. I mean, it really just expands the capabilities. It expands your capabilities. There are problems that are provably unsolvable, right? Like, not just by provably unsolvable, not just by computers, but also by humans, right? So there are sort of theoretical limits to what computers and also humans can do. And I think that, sorry, that's actually a total tangent. That has nothing to do with what I'm about to say. We can talk about that. I mean, it's a really interesting part of sort of theoretical computer science, unsolvable problems, and provably unsolvable problems. You know, as an engineer, I think that better technologies, right, which is what AI ultimately is, will just let you build more and more complex systems. Maybe I'm not being creative enough, but I don't see there being an AI that picks problems to solve and then solves them without any kind of human intervention in the near future. And even if you did have such a system, you would still have to give it sort of objectives and reward functions to guide the sort of problems that it chooses to solve. And, you know, ultimately, I hope that it will still be humanity doing that. In the short term, I think that AI will mean only good things for engineers, because it will mean that engineers are just going to be empowered to build even more complex and even more impactful systems than they already are.
So going back to your mention about provably unsolvable issues and whatnot, do you think there's a chance that we find something that we thought was provably unsolvable, and by some miracle, so to speak, AI could solve that?
Unfortunately, I don't think that that's possible. There are problems that we don't, that are really, really hard, and perhaps our existing model of computation can't support them, but there are some problems that are genuinely impossible. Like, not just, you know, we're not creative enough to figure out how to solve them. They're like, if you could solve this problem, you would essentially create a contradiction in the universe, right? Like, this program literally cannot exist, because if it did exist, it would essentially lead to sort of just a paradox. The classic example is the halting problem, which I'm sure you're probably maybe a little bit familiar with. I don't know. Do you want to talk about that? It's a bit of a tangent. But
I would say, yeah, I think it's a good idea to explain it.
Okay, so let's see. All right. Suppose you had a I'm not going to give you the halting problem. I'm going to give you, you know what? We will do the halting problem. Okay. Suppose you had a program that could take in its own source code, and then from that source code and some input, that program will tell you whether that program will ever stop running, right? Will it go into an infinite loop, right? Will it run forever, or will it eventually stop, right? So let's say we have this program, let's call it will stop, and it takes in two arguments, the source code to a program and some input that you would have passed to that program, right?
Right.
And we can actually, for the purposes of this conversation, we can ignore the input part. So let's just say we have this program, it's called will halt and returns true or false, right? We can literally think of it as a function, and it takes in some source code and it tells you with certainty whether that program that you gave it will run forever or if it will stop running. And I argue that that program cannot exist, right? Being able to determine whether any program will stop, will enter an infinite loop is impossible, like cannot be done. That is just something that we will never know. And here's why. All right. Is the premise of the problem clear?
Yes.
Okay. So now let's say that we have this function called will halt. Now let's write a new program. And what it does is it calls will halt and then it passes that function its own source code, which you can do. That's possible. It's called a quine. Programs can do that. And it's not like some trick of a particular programming language. Like it's fundamental to the idea of computation. Programs can inspect their own source code. And now what this new program is going to do is it's going to call will halt on itself. Right? And if will halt returns true, then the program goes into an infinite loop. And if will halt returns false, right, essentially saying that the program will go into an infinite loop, then the program should not go into an infinite loop. It should just end right then and there. So essentially, we've built a program that does exactly the opposite of what this other program, will halt, says it will do, right?
Right.
And so, like, the fact, so if we assume that will halt exists, then it means that we could write this program. But this program would clearly break will halt because it will do whatever the opposite of will halt says it will do. So what this means is that something has broken down. And the only assumption here that we've made is that the program will halt is possible. And so what that means is because that assumption leads to a contradiction, right? It leads to an impossibility, right? In like a purely mathematical, like in a logical sense, it means that that program cannot exist. It's impossible. And there's nothing we can do, right? We can get good. We can build programs that are good at, for the most part, figuring out whether a program will halt or not, right? But there will always be this paradox when you run it on itself. And so this program can't exist, right? Like even the most sophisticated AI could make a guess. It could make a pretty accurate guess in most cases, but it'll never be able to provide this function with a shadow beyond a shadow of a doubt. Because if you did, then you'd have this paradox, which is sort of this kind of mind-bending result. Right? The fact that there are some problems that we just cannot solve, right? That we do not know.
I guess that is the epitome there. Something that we're told that we can't do, but it actually is something we can't do.
And what's interesting too is that you can apply the principle of the halting problem to all sorts of other types of problems. So, for example, say you had a program, like say you wanted to solve the problem. Okay, does a particular program have a backdoor in it, right? Automated vulnerability scanning, right? Well, what if you crafted a program that called that vulnerability scanner on itself, and if the scanner said that it did have a vulnerability, then it doesn't have that vulnerability, and if the program says that it doesn't have that vulnerability, then it exposes that vulnerability, right? And it seems circular. It seems, you know, it feels like, oh, well, why would we do that? Why don't we just, like, not write that program and then everything's fine? But the problem is, even the fact that we could write that program means that there's something fundamentally off about that program, right? There's something just impossible about it, right? It's beyond the reaches of computation. And when I say beyond the reaches of computation, you know, that actually includes human computation, because, you know, anything a computer can do, given enough time, in theory, a human could do, right? And these aren't the sort of things that can just be solved with creativity, right? Like, when I, you know, perhaps I should reframe the halting problem as not saying, as not, you know, this cannot be solved, and rather say sometimes this has no answer. Right? Like, there are some problems to which there genuinely aren't any answers. It's not that we can't figure out the answer, it's that there is no answer to find out. And so, you know, that's a different way of framing the same idea. But it's, I don't know, maybe that's something exciting. Maybe that's sort of deeply depressing, right? That there are some things that we just cannot know. Right? But you know, it is, and it's been proven, so there's no getting around it, right? You know, yeah, there are all sorts of mind-bending results like this.
Yeah, I mean, that's any science, frankly.
Yeah, I mean, like, there's even the result. There are infinitely many problems that we can't solve because there are more problems than there are programs, which is, like, actually something you can prove. And infinitely many more problems than there are programs, which means that there are infinitely many more problems than there are people. They really do kind of put you in your place as an engineer. You know?
All right, maybe this will work. In theory, I have 5 bars 5G. So I don't know what's going on. Yeah, this is an unsolvable problem. But, yeah.
In my experience, it's usually lying about that 5G part. Or the 5 bars, for that matter.
Yeah. You're just telling me what I want to hear. Yeah, that's next level AI that lies to you to just get you off its case, so it can go back to doing what it loves, whatever that is. Yeah, sounds like code I would write. Anyway, so we've gone on an interesting tangent to theoretical computer science, and like you know some you know I will say, like. I do think that there's a limit to the usefulness of that result, though. Yeah. And what I mean by that is that, you know, humans will make mistakes, right? And the limits to the human brain are pretty well known. I mean, there's so much more we could know. We know barely anything about, you know, the brain, I'm sure. But we do know that we're not that smart. I mean, we're smart, but we're kind of stupid in the grand scheme of things. Anyway, humans are smart, but we know that we're limited, right? Like, we have biases, we have blind spots as humans, and yet that doesn't mean that we're useless. And I think that the same thing can be said for AI systems, right? Just because the problem is theoretically unsolvable doesn't mean that it's always unsolvable. It just means that there are certain special cases where there is no answer. But there are also cases where there is an answer. And I think this actually kind of, to bring this back to AI as it's currently construed kind of in society, right? Let's look at self-driving cars. You know, they could be 5 times more safe than human drivers, but they will still have bugs. They will still have their blind spots. Does that mean that self-driving cars are just, you know, a theoretical impossibility? Well, perhaps it's a theoretical impossibility to have a perfect self-driving car, but do we really need perfect, right? Isn't better than humans or significantly better than humans good enough? You know, and I'm not saying that we should just be, you know, loose, you know, fast and loose when it comes to safety regulation. That is not at all what I'm saying. But, you know, let's not let perfection be the enemy of good.
Yeah, you give me too many good branching points off of that one. I guess we'll go with, obviously, in the tech world, there's a lot of regulations and standardizations. You've got the GDPR and the European Union. You have things like ISO standards and the HIPAA.
I want to almost like partially object to the premise of this question. I think that tech is still in many ways the Wild West, right? For the longest time, the reason that startups were able to succeed was one, because they were moving, you know, they were able to move quickly, they were nimble, blah, 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 they were small. But the other huge reason is that they were able to sidestep a lot of regulation by virtue of being internet platforms. And so, like, yes, like, GDPR exists, but, you know, in practice, you know, what do so many companies do with GDPR? They put on a cookie banner, and then they create a small team within their company that deals with, you know, data requests and data deletion requests. And then they just create a very expansive privacy policy, you know, as you and I both, you know all too well. And then they say, okay, great, we've done GDPR. and I think GDPR is, you know, really great legislation, but the fact that, you know, it's not the solution. It's not, it has, you know, it's made, it's given some people more latitude when it comes to exercising their privacy rights. Totally agree there, right? GDPR has been a good thing, right? It gives you the ability to, you know, request all your data from a company. It gives you the ability to demand that your data be deleted, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm not convinced that it actually makes the sort of privacy, the standard sort of privacy footprint of your typical European much better. You know, because so much of GDPR, as I understand it, ultimately in practice becomes opt-in systems, right? Like, sure, you have the right to delete your data, but it's not automatically deleted if you don't use a platform for, like, you know, a year, right? It's, you must explicitly exercise that right. And so for as long as people aren't doing that in droves, then companies will not really operate under the assumption that they will be having to delete everyone's data, right? Like, they will still just keep as much as they can for as long as they can and do as much as they can with it. It's interesting because, you know, you and I were technical. We are in the world of tech. We are familiar with this legislation. And, you know, to us, it's like, okay, well, there is legislation, tech super regulated. But look at other industries, right? Comparatively, tech is pretty loose. Like, you do have ISO standards. You do have, you know, certain, you know, like, but, you know, I mean, often those regulations are written by folks who are not super familiar with the tech world. And, you know, every system is different. And so it's really hard to standardize these systems and how to, you know, figure out how to regulate them, especially when it comes to security and privacy legislation. Let's get on with your actual question. the point I just wanted to make, though, is that tech, in the grand scheme of things, I'm not sure that it is particularly regulated.
Right. It has some regulations and standardizations, and they're a good starting point. They are far from perfect, so to speak.
Yeah. For sure. And tech companies love to talk about how they're self-regulating, right? Like,
right.
they'll do the right thing, and right. You know, take that as you will.
So obviously, I think it's safe to assume you're on the side of it shouldn't just be self-regulation. It should also have influence from a third party. Who do you think that third party should be? How do you think it should be regulated or standardized? And yeah, I guess that really would be the essence of it.
Yeah, so I think that every type of regulation has its flaw. But I think that if you had sort of joint US-EU regulations, I think that that would honestly be quite good. Although ultimately, I think that the biggest regulators are people themselves, right? Like ordinary citizens. Mm-hmm. And so I think a really important thing is just transparency and explainability, you know, especially in the realm of AI. I think that provided that humans are still able to have sort of insight into the way, for example, their data is being used or the way that decisions that concern them are being made, then I think that, you know, government regulation will follow from that. But it's hard to regulate things that you don't understand. And so for as long as you know, the general public and legislators and their staff, you know, don't fully understand these systems, for as long as they're super locked down and proprietary, I think that we're going to be stuck with bad regulation. And, you know, and bad regulation might be worse, might be better than no regulation at all.
Right. So you're saying we need to inform people like lawmakers and citizens better of how things should ideally be run to benefit people, not to use people. And then we can go forward from there.
Yeah, if we take a perfect view of our democracy, in theory, the will of the American people will inform the actions of the legislators. And the actions of the legislators, of course, then create the legislation and the regulation. So in theory, it should sort of be bottom up. And you should have people understanding and having sort of political opinions about sort of technical systems, and then that will spawn legislation. Of course, that's almost certainly not how it's going to go, right? Like there's always going to be a place for domain experts. I'm not saying that like your average person should be the one crafting your tech legislation, right? Like that is just absurd. But what I'm saying is that, you know, ideally you would have public visibility into technical systems, which could then sort of signal to legislators that, hey, you know, this is the sort of thing that needs to be regulated, or these are the sort of decisions that actually are happening. Let's make sure that we regulate the right thing in the right way. And I think that, you know, legislators probably don't have that much more insight into tech companies than folks like you and me. Sure, they can interface with lobbyists, but the lobbyists aren't going to tell them anything that would possibly put the company in a bad light. So you know, when it comes to looking at the sort of dirty laundry, so to speak, of tech companies, I think that, you know, that sort of public accountability and transparency is the sort of important first step. And also competition, right? Like for as long as you know, for example, Apple has a monopoly on essentially, you know, a large margin of the US mobile market, or I should probably say a plurality. You know, right? Like you're not going to have very much consumer power. And so, you know, the transparency is of relatively limited use, right? Because if there's nothing you can do to escape a system, then you know, what good is the transparency for? I mean, I still think that transparency is still good in that case, but transparency is better when it comes with choice. See, I would say maybe transparency and fewer monopolies. No monopolies, but that's a long way off. So let's just go with fewer for now.
Going back actually to your example of self-driving cars.
Yeah.
We look at roads today. Obviously, car accidents happen, and yeah. We kind of just accept that. It's kind of just something that happens. It's not really newsworthy unless it's a huge crash with several cars.
Right.
But if someone is in a Tesla with autopilot or a different car with their system, yeah. It's humongous news, as if yeah. It's catastrophic. Do you think we're giving that fair justice, or how should we be painting that light? Because it's not a yeah. human doing it anymore. It's AI.
Exactly.
Where's the accountability, yeah. so to speak?
Yeah. So I feel like there are a couple ways that we can approach this. Let's start by maybe I'm going to say that Tesla deserves much of the criticism there. You know, Tesla's self-driving capabilities, they're good, but they're not great. Teslas cannot, as far as I know, you know, have like Waymo-like end-to-end driving capabilities. And yet Tesla's sort of in its marketing, and even in those sort of, and even in what it sort of lets you get away with when you're driving one, is not congruent to the capability of their self-driving system, right? Like, they shouldn't even call it autopilot. They should call it, like, assisted cruise control or something. And, like, I say this as someone who's driven a Tesla and has a sense for what it's capable of. And I'm not saying that, you know, it's a bad thing, right? Like, it's probably, in the case of highway driving, safer than a human driver. But let's not pretend that it's perfect. You know, and Tesla should be upfront about that. In terms of the news angle, I think this is just classic, you know, man bites dog versus dog bites man, right? Dog bites man, who cares? Man bites dog, then that's a story. And, I think that fear-mongering is probably misplaced. Well, it's absolutely misplaced. I think that fear-mongering over self-driving cars is a terrible thing, because I think that's going to lead to sort of material damage. I think that, you know, I think that will prolong the adoption of self-driving cars, which will lead to more and more traffic deaths every single day. But I can't fault the news media for focusing so much on those deaths. And, you know, often what happens is, like, you know, I mean, there's so many videos on YouTube, which I love, of Teslas avoiding crashes, where, like, you see some crazy scenario or some crazy traffic issue, like someone, like, pulls out in front of someone else at the last second at an intersection, and, like, the Tesla magically swerves and saves the day. And that's awesome, and I wish that that got more coverage than it did, but I'm not surprised, and I don't think that it's out of character that sort of the media, broadly construed, draws so much attention to sort of the AI gone wrong story, because their incentives are not to tell, to give an accurate picture of the world as it is. Their incentive is to, I don't want to say create drama, but draw attention to themselves and keep you engaged. And it's more interesting to read about a crash than it is to read about a near miss. Which is a shame, but it's kind of the way we are.
Right. Well, thank you so much for what was half an hour and turned out to be an hour.
Oh yeah, I don't care. I'm just in the car.
Gives you something to pass the time, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
I appreciate it once again. Thank you.
Yeah, for sure. I will
definitely take you up on that offer the next time I've got a chance and I'm in the
seriously.
Area.
Yeah, please do. Yeah, I mean
we'd both be
eager to, you know, use our dining hall meal swipes, our guest swipes, and give you repay you for the time that you've put in. I think I have a backlog of policies I need to merge.
It's never ending, it seems.
Well, you know what though? It's a good problem to have.
Yeah, that's true.